Hello, everyone, and welcome to another all-new Salt and Light Hour. I'm Deacon Pedro.
I always say the magic moment is when somebody says, I always wanted to, and they fill in the blank, because that means they're hoping again. That means they believe it's possible, means they're brave enough to speak it. And then that's where we can step in and say, okay, tell me more about that, and give them, and then start to layer in the services that help them get there over time.
That's the voice of Angie Peters, the president and CEO of the Yonge Street Mission in Toronto and the author of Just Act, We Are the Solution to Poverty. We're going to be hearing from Angie in just a few minutes and learn a few simple things that we can all do to solve the problem of poverty. So that's Angie Peters solving poverty in about 5 minutes. And then Ed Clancy of Aid to the Church in Need USA will be with us to tell us about the situation in Nigeria that's more and more in the mainstream and social media. So that's in about 20 minutes, Aid to the Church in Need, where God helps. And then...
I had a unique experience. When I was about 15 years old, a group of priests came give a concert at our... Okay. Religion class named the Damians.
Oh yeah.
So I'm gonna show my age here.
Yeah, I was gonna say, but I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with the Damians. Yeah.
And at that time, I felt a strong calling toward music ministry and the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And shortly after that, I started the first youth and children's choir at our family church in Iberia.
That is Mark Hargrave, our featured singer-songwriter today. Mark Hargrave is a songwriter from Louisiana who's been doing music for most of his life, and we're going to be speaking with him in our second half hour. Remember to subscribe to the Salt and Light Hour podcast wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss any of our programs. And if you're looking for a good organization to support, consider Mary's Meals that provides a nutritious daily meal to more than 3 million children each day in school. Check them out. marysmeals.org. So let's get started. Here's a song. This is Mark Hargrave with Take My Hand.
Take my hand, come to me, I will carry you through the storm. Shine through you and keep you warm. Take my hand, I will be with you. Take my hand, I will see. I'm here for you. Take my hand.
Life sometimes seems unfair because I don't understand what life.
We're listening to Mark Hargrave with his single, Take My Hand. And we're going to be speaking with Mark Hargrave in about 20 minutes, so stay tuned. According to Statistics Canada, a bit more than one in four households experienced some level of food insecurity in Canada in 2024. This is the highest rate ever recorded. Also, between 2023 and 2024, just over 30% of Canadians experienced homelessness. But poverty may not be visible. There are many others who may be not homeless, but are struggling to pay their bills. They may be in your parish community. To explain a bit more about the reasons for poverty and to find out what we can do, recently I spoke with Angie Peters. She is the president and CEO of the Yonge Street Mission in Toronto, and she's also the author of Just Act, We Are the Solution to Poverty. She says that if you and I did just one thing to make a difference in the life of just one person, we would be well on our way to eradicate poverty. Angie, welcome to the Salt and Light Hour.
It is so good to be here. Thank you, Deacon Pedro.
It is good to have you. So how did you get involved or interested in working with the issue of poverty?
You know, there's a couple answers to that question, but I guess most specifically, a real true sense of calling emerged for me at some point in my life. I had originally been in telecommunications as a salesperson. That was my first career for 16 years. And it was after my youngest child was born, I went back to work. And at that point, I was an area vice president of sales for Lucent Technologies. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of had this sense of dissonance, like not that it was, I mean, it was a great organization. They were wonderful. But I was just like, I don't know. I don't know that this is it. And I'd never been a kid who knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I was doing a Bible study with a group of church, and we were going through the book of Ephesians. And I read, you know how sometimes you read a verse you've read a million times before, but this time it hits you right between the eyes?
It happens all the time. Yes.
Right? So yes. I read Ephesians 2:10 that says that God created good works in advance for us to do. And I thought, And then I said the most dangerous prayer I've ever said in my life. I said, okay, God, if you created good works in advance for me to do, and I don't know what I want to do anyway, I can't imagine that I could think of something better for my life than you have picked up for it. So if you show me, I'll do it. And that began the long journey back to, or to where I am, really. There's a bunch of steps in between there, but that's what got me here.
Right. And I would think, I mean, this is kind of taking us in a little bit of a different direction, but I would think that those seeds that led you to where you are today didn't start when you made that prayer. I'm sure that God was already working in your heart, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really funny because in his great sense of humor, Yonge Street Mission is actually just a few blocks away from where my family moved when I was a child. Okay. So I was born in Halifax, lived in Montreal, ended up in Toronto, and living on Riverdale Avenue before Riverdale was Riverdale.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And the Don Jail was still in operation then. It was quite a depressed area.
Yeah.
And I was raised by a mom, you know, a single mom with three kids. I was the middle child. Mm-hmm. And so there's a backstory there with my mom's history coming out of generational poverty.
Right.
And so I think my heart for the poor was rooted in my upbringing and my family of origin.
Absolutely.
And so I think God in his divine sense of humor said, okay, this is what I have for you. I'm going to have you, I'm going to plant you in a place serving blocks away from where you started in the city, serving families just like yours.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit about Yonge Street Mission and the work that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So Yonge Street Mission is 129 years old now.
Incredible.
We were founded back during the social gospel movement of the late 1800s, like many organizations across North America. And we're still doing the work of serving the poor. That's what we were founded to do, and we still are. We've maintained our Christian identity. So we're 100% Christian staff and board, ecumenical, different Christian faith traditions. And we serve, you know, at this stage, we have six buildings in the downtown east.
Yes.
And we serve three populations. We focus on vulnerable youth who may be homeless or precariously housed. Mm-hmm. And then the second population is families in crisis, and that's largely single parent families for the most part. And then the third population is what we call our Bridges population, but it's individuals who come from generational poverty. So that deeply entrenched chronic poverty. And so we have all the services that can help a person, you know, heal and build confidence in themselves and find value in themselves and believe that their life can change and then move through all of the supports. You know, I always say the magic moment is when somebody says, I always wanted to.
Yeah.
And they fill in the blank because that means they're hoping again. That means they believe it's possible. It means they're brave enough to speak it. Mm-hmm. And then that's where we can step in and say, okay, tell me more about that, and give them, and then start to layer in the services that help them get there over time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I can say that Yonge Street Mission, you guys do great work. You've used the term generational poverty twice, and mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure. I think I can figure out what it means, but can you kind of expand that a little for us? What do you mean by generational? Are you talking about families or people who are find themselves stuck in a cycle of poverty that goes for more than one generation?
Yeah, basically, yeah. So if you look at poverty, you can break it down into, I mean, simplistically stated, three types, mm-hmm. right? Episodic. Episodic, when you hear the Bible, you know, we will always have the poor among us, right? I think that's the episodic poverty, right?
Right.
You know, in the sense that that's life stuff. I lost my job. I'm not well. I need support. I get better. I go back, right?
Mm-hmm.
People who are seniors or who are unable to work, they shouldn't be poor. That's a different societal issue. We should just be looking after them.
Right.
But chronic poverty is actually a big chunk of the people who are experiencing poverty. Mm-hmm. And it's people who, it's their grandparents and then their parents and then them and then their kids will be, like, unless we do something different.
Right. So they just can't get out of that cycle.
Yeah. And they can't get out of the cycle. Yeah.
So are there reasons? I mean, I'm sure that there are, and you wrote a whole book about it, but maybe one or two reasons that you can highlight for our listeners, because I would say that this is a systematic in our society, the way we're dealing or handling poverty, that make it difficult for these people to get out of that generational poverty cycle.
Yeah, there are. And if it's okay, I'll tell a story.
Yeah.
So, Barbara was a young woman, oldest of 11 children, and her dad was an alcoholic and just wasn't a safe household. And I won't get into all the details, but at a certain age, she was taken out of school, even though she loved school. She was studying. She was doing great to go to work and help provide for the family and to raise her younger siblings. And because she did that, her younger siblings thrived and the family got by. But as she got older, because she experienced a lot of trauma in that household, as she got older, she decided she wanted a family for herself because she loved kids. And yet she had all this trauma. So she went about it in a way that wasn't ideal for her or anybody else. And so what she did was she ended up having three children with three different men. And so at this point in the story, we see Barbara living in subsidized housing on social income, trying to raise her three children on her own. And suffering with depression and agoraphobia, which means she never wanted to leave the house. She was afraid to leave the house. So we look at that, right? And we go, that's desperate. What could ever change about that person? And that feeds into a lot of our thoughts about how we understand the poor, right?
Right.
Maybe she wants to be there. Maybe she's milking the system. Maybe, you know, like all these things that people think, right?
Right.
But here's where the story gets really different. And this is the point of my book. This is where I really firmly believe we can all do something that could change and end poverty in one generation for everybody that comes after them. Because this is where two people stepped into Barbara's life and did something that was so totally normal that they thought it was nothing, but it changed everything. And the first one was a piano teacher. So Barbara somehow wrangled piano lessons for her oldest daughter. And her oldest daughter goes toddling off to piano lessons by herself because Barbara's afraid to leave the house, remember?
Right.
And she gets there and the piano teacher goes, this is odd, right? This little one showing up by themselves. And the piano teacher was a woman of faith and she was a caregiver. So she decided to reach out to Barbara to get to know her. And then she started to invest in her. And so she helped Barbara find healing in her faith with God. She helped her understand the other resources that were available to her. And the main gift that she gave her was believing that she had value and that her life could change. So that's the piano teacher. So out goes the piano teacher. Barbara moves along, finds a different neighborhood, healthier for her family. Ordinary person number two steps in. Pat, the mom of a little boy that her son played with. So she meets a more hopeful Barbara who says, I always wanted to go back to work, but like, I'm afraid. I don't know how. Mm-hmm. Pat works. She says, let me help you. Asks her some questions, yada, yada, yada. Long story short, Barbara takes some classes. And then Pat hires her.
Hmm.
So we go from this desperate situation to two normal people doing something that was like, they didn't think they were doing anything.
Right.
Like, no big deal. And now Barbara's leaving the house, providing for her children. And here's where a generational poverty ends.
Mm-hmm.
Her three children are better off. Her five grandchildren are better off. And the impact is continuing because I know this because Barbara was my mother and I was the little girl who toddled off to piano lessons.
Mm-hmm.
So the impact, the legacy of those two women choosing to see someone and just do what was natural for them to do changed everything. And it even includes what I'm doing now.
Yeah, of course. And thank you for sharing that personal story, your story, the story of your mom, Barbara. What you're saying, if I can say it simply, and because I think it's very clear, is that you're saying that everyone can be like those two women, the piano teacher, doing something really simple that we don't think is anything much that can make a difference in the life of someone and help them come out of that cycle of poverty. So I would assume that the reason why most of us are not doing that is because we have, and you spoke a little bit about these misconceptions that we might have ideas about, you know, we might make judgments. So what are some of those misconceptions that maybe we need to kind of jog out of our heads so that we can move beyond that and start making a difference in the lives of people that might be in our church or in our neighborhood?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the first thing is if you know, we're afraid, we don't know how to engage. Like if you... Mm-hmm. You see people, and now there's so much mental illness and substance abuse.
Yeah.
Like you're afraid. You don't know how to. Like I'm not, and I think that's wise. If you're not trained, you should not approach somebody who's having an episode, right?
Right.
But there are so many things we can do, and I think the first misconception is that keeps us from doing something is other than fear is we believe the system is there, and that should be doing enough, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where. The system has changed a lot. So you know what? In my mother's day, that was kind of true. The system was there. But we stopped funding it in this province. So I know it's a broader audience, but people could look in their own context. But in Canada, we stopped funding it in the 90s. So Barbara was living in social assistance, which had her at the poverty line. And she was living in social housing, which made her rent 30% of her social assistance, which means she had 70% left and she had a fighting chance. And the system, you didn't get weaned off the system till you went above the poverty line. Well, today, Pedro, in this province, if you're on the social system, you're getting anywhere between 20 and 60% below the poverty line as your payments. And Canada has one of the lowest percentages of social housing in the OECD. It's at around 3%.
Right.
And so there is no social housing. So you've got an income, let's say 40% below the poverty line.
Mm-hmm.
And you're living in market rental. All of your money goes to rent. And on top of that, the system still starts to wean you off it before you get to the poverty line. So if you go get a part-time job, they say, very good. They'll call you and say, we're going to take that off your benefits. So it keeps pushing you back down before you can even get to the poverty line. So it is literally every day a challenge of what meal do I skip? What bill do I pay? You know, how do I survive?
Right.
And it takes so much energy to survive that people don't think long term. How do you think long term if that's your reality?
Yeah. And I don't think
That's the biggie.
Yeah. It sounds like you're talking about funding, but I get the sense that you're not just talking about we need to throw more money at the problem. And I think people should read your book so that they can find out a little bit more about how that works. And as you said, it might be different in different municipalities and definitely is different in different countries around the world. Some countries, some municipalities have found solutions. You've been exploring some solutions. Can you tell us maybe one that you think might be maybe the place to start in terms of finding the right solution for your community? Maybe it's systematic at a government level or a community level?
Yeah. I think there's both a community level and a systematic level conversation, right?
Yeah.
Because both are important, right? One is immediate relief, and the other is let's change the system that's creating this challenge,
of course,
right?
Of course.
So on the immediate relief side, you know, I think that, you know, the book talks about a process you can go through. It's very simple to come up with your one thing, like what's in your bucket. You think about an old-fashioned bucket brigade.
Yeah.
And Pat and the piano teacher, they each did what was in their bucket at a different point in time in someone's life. So you don't have to worry about solving everything in a person's life and let that hold you back. You can figure out what, you know, I often ask people, have you ever helped somebody find a job? Your kids or your friend's kids? And everybody puts their hands up. It's like, congratulations, you know how to help somebody find a job, right?
Yeah, of course.
And so there's lots of examples like that in the book, like where you just don't even know what you know.
It's so simple.
That's easy for you. And this simple process helps you like find the thing. And then I always just say, just always be helping one person with the thing that's in your bucket. Mm-hmm. Don't overwhelm yourself, right? And if you finish helping one person with the thing that's in your bucket, look for the next person to help with that same thing.
Right.
Don't make it complicated. Just go do the one thing. And if you're not sure, I always encourage people to volunteer for an agency near them for a little bit that is serving the kind of people when they think about it, that's what breaks their heart. Go volunteer there, learn what you can do, and then just start doing it. It's that simple.
Yeah. I like that.
On a systemic level, Peter, the biggest issue I would say is housing. I mentioned earlier that, you know, Canada has really let itself fall way behind. Like, we are behind globally with the amount of social housing that we've created, and we've dug ourselves a big hole, and we desperately need it. I went back to that example of the cost of all of everything you earn is your rent.
Yeah.
You don't have much chance, right? And so we've got to, I would just encourage people to understand that situation, like just learn a little bit about it. And the thing about politics is, in any country, I mean, politicians don't do brave things. They do what the public supports.
Of course.
So if we understood and said to our politicians uniformly, yeah, you guys go double the amount of social housing now, like fund it, make it happen, because for-profit developers are not going to do that. They're looking for a profit, and that's fair. Mm-hmm. I'm not judging them for that.
Mm-hmm.
This comes back to the year of Jubilee. And Leviticus 25. And you go back and look at Leviticus 25, and it's essentially an economic reset where it says, restore the land back to the people who it belonged to.
Yeah.
Which by definition means in God's economy, the land didn't belong to us. It even says that. The land is not yours. You're living on it as foreigners and strangers. It's mine. Mm-hmm. It should never be sold permanently. It says that in Leviticus 25. So restore the land. So that means in that day, in that economy, people had a place to live and they could work the land to have food to eat.
Yeah.
And so that's, I think it's a very clear principle. How do we, in our current economy, make sure people have a place to live and the headroom, the headspace to work so that they can provide the food that they need for their family?
Yeah. That's so good. And I think that, I mean, at least if I can say for our listeners, just understanding how that works in terms of housing. It's not that, you know, people are spending money on other things and they can't afford, you know, their house. Is that, you know, there's a reality there. And the other thing that I was going to say is just to clarify, you're not suggesting like that personal thing that I can do. You're not suggesting necessarily that I need to go help that person that I see sitting on the street corner every morning asking for change, because there might be someone in my own parish that sits in the pew next to me that maybe I haven't invested in getting to know. And maybe she is a single mom. She's not homeless, but she's struggling. And maybe that's the person that I can, that's what's in my bucket that I can help. And I think that that's kind of what I hear you saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I liken it to the emergency department and community, like you, agencies like ours, we're the emergency department.
Yeah.
We've got the trained staff for the individuals who need a lot more support to be ready to move forward.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have time, you can fund people like us, right? So we can do that work if that breaks your heart. But in your neighborhood, there's lots of people who've gone through all those steps and they're ready for someone like you to step beside them.
Exactly.
Help them with the things that are their next goal, which could be like upgrading their education or getting a job or needing some food to get by while they're upgrading their education.
Right. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of solutions and how important it is to involve the people that you're helping, the people that are in poverty, engage them in finding those solutions. And I'm particularly interested in the Hack Poverty Initiative. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that works or why that works?
Yeah. So that was really fun. So basically Hack Poverty came out of a hackathon that I did a few years ago where I brought together four single parents who were experiencing poverty as a leadership group. And we designed and invited and had 34 leaders show up, cross-sectoral leaders in the city, to try to come up with solutions that would help those families, people like them. And it was led by them. And right. Even when the group came up with five ideas, they gave the ideas to the parents, and the parents said, oh, those are good ideas, but these three matter and nuance them this way. Work on that.
Right.
Those have turned into three working groups that are co-chaired by a person with lived experience and a sector leader.
Right.
Two of them have come up with pilots, and one of them is still working on a housing challenge. But like one of the pilots is great. It's an income and benefits pilot. And the idea is to create a framework for businesses that say, the normal journey of someone in their employment has four phases, and it looks like this. And in each of those four phases, this is what an employer could do to help them. So that when employers are like, I don't know if I can help. I don't know how to help, Ange. How do I employ the people you work with? We say, here's a table. Can you do this? Do you have short-term jobs for someone who's not ready for full-time? And they can go, yeah, I do that. I can do that. Okay, I can do that. And then they start doing that. Mm-hmm. And one of our employers started doing that, and they thought they could never employ anybody full-time. Since they started, they hired six people.
Yeah, that's great.
So they figured out how they could, right? And
right.
So it's just a solution that the group together came up with.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a collective intelligence plus a person who struggled with employment in the room coming up with something that is a very real solution. So we're going to be publishing it in the coming year and getting it out there so all employers can look at it and go, oh, okay, I didn't think I could help, but look, I can do number two, or I can do number mm-hmm. three, or I can do number one. And mm-hmm. then they can just pick it and do it.
That's wonderful. I really look forward to your publishing that and also sharing it with other, because I keep thinking of, you know, there's municipalities all over, countries all over that might be looking at these. I wish we had so much more time, Angie, because it's so good. But people can get your book. And what I like about your book is that it's not, you know, it's just all theories. It's a lot of stories and a lot of really practical solutions and suggestions and advice. So Thank you for that. And thank you for sharing a little bit about what you do with us today. And I hope you have a blessed end of the Advent season and a Merry Christmas.
Thank you so much, Deacon Pedro.
Angie Peters is the president and CEO of Yonge Street Mission and is the author of Just Act, We Are the Solution to Poverty.
As we prepare our hearts this season, there's a beautiful way to share Christ's love in a real and practical way. Mary's Meals brings daily school meals to children in some of the world's poorest and most remote communities, reaching more than 3 million children every school day. These meals don't just fill stomachs. They encourage children into the classroom, where they can learn, grow, and begin to climb the ladder out of poverty. If you're looking for a gift that reflects our call to serve with compassion, you can give one with true purpose. And the remarkable part, it costs just $31.70 to feed a child for an entire school year. It's a simple act that makes a profound difference. To learn more or offer a meaningful gift this season, visit marysmeals.ca and join us in bringing nourishment, dignity, and hope to children around the world.
Coming up in our second half hour, we meet our featured artist, Mark Hargrave, so stay tuned. Welcome to the Salt and Light Hour Part 2. I'm Deacon Pedro. Now it's time for Where God Helps, with Ed Clancy from Aid to the Church in Need, USA. Ed, welcome back to the Salt and Light Hour.
Thank you, Deacon. It's good to be with you all.
It is good to be with you. And you and I have spoken about Nigeria many times before, but now it seems that finally Nigeria seems to be in the news. So I would suspect that that's a good thing.
No, it is. It's definitely something that's a positive in that, for an unfortunate reason, obviously, with the persecution there. But for years and years, it's been seemingly the church being the town crier that no one hears, saying that the situation there is not good for Christians and that there needs to be more focus put upon the protection, safety, and the welfare, the general welfare of Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Each year, Nigeria leads in the number of those martyred for the faith, Christians martyred for mm-hmm. the faith. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 of 80% of all the people killed in the world die in Nigeria.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's just surprising. Because Nigeria is also a country that has, like, I don't know, I'm not going to say the most vocations, but all the priestly vocations.
Well, they might very well.
Yeah.
It's hard to say, you know, as far as numbers and percentages, but they have the highest mass attendance of any Catholic community in the world, over 90%.
Wow.
They have seminaries which literally are turning away young men.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, looking to fill seats. In some communities, the church actually requires the local community to support them in providing mm-hmm. housing for the seminarians, because there's just not enough room in the seminary.
Right.
And this is the status. The same thing for religious vocations and the brothers and sisters. They too have similar situations. So it's a church obviously under duress. And thank God for the news, even though, you know, we can say how positive is it, but the fact that it's being focused upon. Mm-hmm. Deacon, a couple of weeks ago, 300 students and teachers were abducted from a Catholic school.
Yeah.
And normally that goes in and out of the news headlines. You know, it's in for 1 week and then it disappears.
Yeah.
It seems like now, finally, the government is doing something. We had 100 of them released recently, and usually it's the church right. that needs to do all the work. This time it seems that the government was the main actor, the agency that helped to release these 100. And we pray that the others are
that
released.
Will be as released
many
as
times
well, yeah.
These people are transported. They're sent to other places, and, you know, it becomes almost impossible to find them. There's 86 of the Chibok girls from
yep.
11 years ago still unaccounted for.
Yeah.
And each one of those young women, you know, essentially has lived maybe more than half their life in either slavery, captivity, or some sort of, in a terrible situation.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, so it seemed to me that the church had a lot of influence with the government. Definitely they have a lot of influence with the people. Do you think that that's a little bit of what's happening, or there's also international pressure?
It's definitely a blend of things. It's the fact that the church's voice is being listened to and responded to. Mm-hmm. And also the fact that there is now diplomatic pressure from outside of the country to mm-hmm. say, get your act together. Because, you know, the Nigerian government has either been, you know, quite frankly, complicit or just non-reactive to these situations. You know, mm-hmm. we have heard many reports of requests for police aid going and taking 3 or 4 days to respond. Can you imagine? There's a situation, a violent situation in town, and 3 or 4 days later they come. What do? Count the bodies and, you know, take pictures right. of the damage. It's not viable. It's not, you can't expect, and especially in Nigeria, where you have communities that do not have the ability to police themselves. They're not allowed to.
No.
They're not allowed to have local police departments that were essentially of any means. And the same thing, states can't even respond. The federal government has to do everything. And mm-hmm. right now it's completely in the control of Muslims who are not prioritizing the needs of Christians.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that, these are the kinds of things that we don't know about because we don't hear, but that the Vatican could have had some in terms of their international relations?
Yeah, they're definitely always, moving something. But obviously, you know, the Vatican can do things diplomatically. They can mm-hmm. put some pressure. But if there's not going to be international partners, if there's not going to be countries who will stand side by side with the Holy See, it's very difficult for the Vatican to do much more than, you know, raise awareness, raise prayers. Obviously, all of those things are good, but we need to help more. We need, as you know, the Western nations and the nations of Europe, et cetera, to say that this is not tenable, this is not acceptable for Christians to be treated this way.
Yeah, but certainly the Pope has mentioned Nigeria. Oh, I mean, the Pope is mentioning all kinds of regions all the time,
yeah.
and obviously most recently during his visit to Lebanon and Turkey, he would have been bringing to mind some of these regions.
Yeah, yeah. And it's good. It's good in all ways that the Holy See, United States and other countries are actually speaking up. And now it seems like Nigeria is realizing they're responsible for some protection and safety of the Christians.
Do you think that the Pope's visit to Lebanon and Turkey kind of highlights what could happen in a place like Nigeria if Christians
Absolutely.
Continue to be killed?
Absolutely. We see in those two countries, Lebanon, which is, you know, by constitution has a Christian presence in government and mm-hmm. place. It was a country that was majority Christian, 60 or 70%. we'll say 50 or 100 years ago. And right. Now it's down to, you know, a minority, a large minority of 30 or 40% Christians. On the other side, you have Turkey, which was the center of Christianity. It yeah. was the it was Rome after Rome.
Yeah.
When Rome fell, Constantinople was the center of Christendom. And at that time, it was, you know, a glorious place for Christian, you know, creation mm-hmm. and creativity. And that went from the center of the church to today, where there's 30 or 40,000 Christians in the whole country. But yeah. the Pope's visit, you know, again, highlights that the church remained. Mm-hmm. And of course, the need for us to work together with our brothers in the faith and the Orthodox communities is also very important, because you see that in Lebanon. Lebanon, even though there is a very large Catholic presence, there are other communities as well. And this is true throughout the Middle East. So we really have to work as Christian brothers and not be, you know, bickering over things that in the end are not as important as the safety and the welfare and the general, you know, spirit of the community.
Of course. Now, going back to Nigeria, in terms of the involvement of Aid to the Church in Need and other partner organizations that are doing relief work and doing assistance and supporting the Christian communities, have you seen any change? Is it easier, or is it still difficult for you guys to do your work?
Well, it's new in this sort of changed atmosphere, but we haven't stopped. So Aid to the Church in Need has been working in Nigeria, supporting vocations, supporting the local priest,
yep.
the pastoral life of the church, you know, for over 50 years. And you know, again, it's one of our prime countries of support, mm-hmm. partially because just the great number, between 35 and 40 million Catholics in Nigeria. And obviously, they're attending Mass, they're producing vocations, their schools are full. And again, oftentimes, even in the north, the Catholic schools are supporting the greater majority of the Muslim children mm-hmm. and giving them advanced education that the government has been failing. So we see, again, in the north, the top scholarship winners, the best students, all are coming out of the Catholic school system.
Mm-hmm.
And this is even though the government spends quite a bit of money relatively for education in the area, that the Catholic schools and the Catholic community is, as they might say, is, you know, outpunching its weight, in that it's creating a greater repercussions and greater, you know, sort of, again, you know, speaking about salt and light in the East, the fact that we are just a small amount, but it's very important for the greater whole.
Yeah, absolutely. I always love that image of the salt, just a little bit of salt and then the yeast, that's what makes a difference. So yeah. obviously funds are needed. Prayers are always needed. That's the yes. most important one, but also awareness. So letting
correct.
People know.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you suggest to our listeners?
No,
that
I mean, it's important, even though there's positive movement, don't let it stop.
Exactly.
When the Chibok girls were taken many years ago and Archbishop Kaigama came to visit, mm-hmm. he said, you know, 3 weeks after the Chibok girls were abducted, where are the headlines?
Yeah.
We're now 11 years later, they're forgotten.
Yeah.
And that's what we can't allow to happen. So we have to make sure there's awareness. We have to pray for them. And when there is the ability, we have to help them as much as we can.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is not that we can only help at this time of the year, but this is a time of year when a lot of people are thinking yeah. of helping. So if I can put in a plug there, that if people are thinking of supporting financially, consider Aid to the Church in Need. They're doing great, great work, not just in Nigeria, but in so many other places yeah. around the world, places that we don't even know exist. So Ed, thank you for always bringing us a little bit of hope, but also bringing yeah. awareness to a lot of situations that are important that people learn
right.
about.
Some light in the darkness.
Absolutely. A little bit of salt, yeah. a little bit of light.
Yep.
Thank
Very
you so
good.
Much. And continued blessings during the Advent season, and a Merry Christmas to you and to all
thank
the staff
you.
At Aid
and
to the
all
Church
your listeners as well. And to you too, Deacon. Thank you for your kindness.
Ed Clancy is the Director of Outreach for Aid to the Church in Need USA. You can find out more about Aid to the Church in Need. If you're in the U.S., it's churchinneed.org. And if you're in Canada, aidcn-canada.org. Here now is our featured artist of the week, Mark Hargrave, with his single, Food for the Journey. Thank you.
can drink. This is his body. This is his blood. A cherished gift. A memory. Christ's sacrifice that set us free. Food for the journey, his body and blood. Strength for the weary, a river of love. Come to the altar, partake and receive. In his presence we gather and believe. Sacrament, we find our peace. Open his promise, our fears release. Like the sacred bread from the ark of old, revealed among us. God's love we told.
We're listening to Mark Hargrave with Food for the Journey. Mark Hargrave grew up and still lives in Cajun Country, Louisiana, and has been making music for most of his life. A divine moment led him to music ministry, and the rest is history. As well as releasing albums with Sunlight, a parish choir he directed, he also published a solo album titled Footprints in the Sand in 2002. Today, Mark continues to fulfill his dream of writing, recording, and sharing his music. To tell us more, I am now joined by Mark Hargrave. Mark, welcome to the Salt and Light Hour.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So I always like to hear a little bit about people growing up. So you grew up in Louisiana. What was that like?
It was great. I grew up in this Cajun town of New Iberia. I have a twin sister named Melinda. Who sadly passed away from cancer 30 years ago.
Right.
I have an older sister, Jackie. My childhood was rich in faith. I often remember my mother praying the rosary a lot.
Oh, yeah?
Which has fostered, I think, my own devotion to the rosary today. She taught me all my prayers. And my father took me to church every Sunday. I find from a young age, around 7 or 8, I felt a strong calling from God. I would often go outside, lay down on the grass, I'd look at the clouds, and I could sense God's presence in my life. It was a
really
great feeling. I felt that He was guiding me. And at one point, I considered becoming a priest.
Okay.
And my father discouraged that.
Mm.
He said it would be a lonely life. I also had a dream of getting married, having kids, and eventually met a Cajun girl, got married, and we have one daughter and three grandkids.
That's beautiful. So it sounds like, obviously, it was a very Catholic family.
Absolutely.
Which I think it's common in that part of the country. The Cajun country is very, very Catholic.
Very
community.
Catholic. Yes.
Was it a musical household? I also get this idea that all Cajun families are musical.
Well, my mother, I think mostly my mother, we had the radio playing all the time.
Yeah.
And I love music. And I've listened to music. I go to sleep listening to music.
Yeah.
So we always had music playing. I used to love trying to figure out harmonies with the songs that were playing on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So my daddy liked to sing, so I think I probably got some of my vocals from him.
Right.
And at Christmas time, we would sing Christmas carols together with my sisters and my dad.
Yeah. When did you start playing? You play guitar. When did you start playing?
I started playing guitar. I had a unique experience. When I was about 15 years old, a group of priests came give a concert at our religion class named the Damians.
Oh yeah.
I'm gonna show my age here.
I was gonna say, but I'm sure a lot of our listeners are familiar with the Damians. Yeah.
And at that time, I felt a strong calling toward music ministry and the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And shortly after that, I started the first youth and children's choir at our family church in Iberia.
Okay.
Started lead music at Mass over the years, and it was just a blessing. I had many choirs through the years, and I don't think I really fully appreciate the blessings that I received from singing and leading Mass.
I can imagine. I have a similar experience. So let me go back. So you said you were around 15 years old. You had this experience at the concert with the Damians, and then next thing, as a teenager, you were leading, you know, directing choirs in church.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
A folk choir. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that long after that concert I began writing songs. I was in band in high school.
In high school,
Took up chorus.
Yeah,
played piano. And it was at that time that right before that time I started playing guitar. Music became a vital source of joy for me.
Yeah,
it was a way to express my faith, and especially during challenging times.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. It sounds like your music and faith were very, very much integrated. So even when you were writing songs, you were mostly writing faith-based songs or songs that could, for worship?
All was faith-based.
Yeah.
And I can still visualize myself sitting on the back porch of a house, playing my guitar, watching the sunset, and just feeling the presence of God. So I felt the presence of God at such an early age, mm-hmm. and just guiding me. And even through the trying times of my life, he was just always there.
Right.
And I just felt like he just brought me to this time in my life through the struggles and everything. But I think music played a big part of my life, playing the guitar,
mm-hmm.
writing and singing.
Now, but you did not go and pursue a professional music career. I think that you always continued playing at church.
That's right. I thought about that. And I think it's easier now for people to be able to do that. But at the time, it was hard. There mm-hmm. was no internet. The internet was just getting ready to come into play. And I had dreams. But it's funny. I thought about that the other day. I said, you know what? The Mass is the biggest concert.
It is.
You know, so just being able to lead music at Mass, which was such a special blessing for me that I was able to do that for so many years.
Yeah.
And have so many choirs.
Now the internet, things have changed. So now you've been recording and putting some new music out. Are you still, and I want to talk about the songs, but are you still playing at Mass or directing? You've stopped that.
About a year ago, I've directed many, many choirs. About a year ago, I retired a few years ago, and I decided to start recording again. About 2002, I did a CD of some songs that I've written.
Yeah,
CD was called Footprints in the Sand,
mm-hmm.
and one of the songs you're going to play, "Take My Hand," was from that.
Right.
But a few years ago, I reconnected with a friend of mine, David Smith, who is a producer and has a recording studio.
Okay.
And I decided I wanted to start recording again and start putting out my music to the world.
And these are new songs or songs that you had written?
These are brand new songs.
Yeah, these are brand new songs. Yeah, we just heard, just before you came on, we heard Food for the Journey. So I believe that's a recent one, right?
That's my latest song.
Is it? is it? And what was kind of like your inspiration for that song? It's a Eucharistic song, right?
Yes. When I was recording the song prior to that, Our Lady of Love, my producer, David, said, you know, the production publication companies are really looking for communion songs right now, since it was the year of the Eucharist.
Yeah.
So after I recorded Our Lady of Love, I started working on a communion song. And it was at that time, my pastor at our church gave a homily about the Eucharist that really touched me. And I remember going home and writing some words down for a chorus of a song. So I just taken those words and the other stuff I was working on, it just food for the journey just kind of came together.
Yeah, oh, good.
And decided to record it.
Yeah, for sure. And then you mentioned Our Lady of Love, so that's also
reflecting that one was
your love for Our Lady. Yeah.
Yeah. My wife and I were assisting at a Eucharistic miracle exhibit at our church. The one at Carlo Acutis.
Yeah, the Carlo Acutis. Carlos, yes, yes.
Put together.
Okay, wow.
And I was deeply moved by the background music playing. They were looping it and asked the coordinator, I said, where is that from? He said, it was from the stars from the Tilma of Our Lady of Guadalupe. And what they did was they took the stars
and
put it on a rolling pin.
Yes.
The old style rolling pin on piano.
Yep.
And when they played it, it made this beautiful melody.
I've heard it.
So,
yes.
So I downloaded it off the internet and started looping it during my prayer time in the morning. And not long after that, this music started flowing through me, and the words, Our Lady of Love, with arms open wide, came to me. And I said, I never heard that title before. I even Googled it, Our Lady of Love, and I might have found a few hits.
Right.
So I just prayed to the Blessed Mother for her guidance in composing this song. And Our Lady of Love was born.
That's wonderful. I have heard about the music of the stars of the mantle of Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Yeah.
Thank you for telling us that story. We're going to end the program by playing Our Lady of Love, so that'll serve as a nice introduction. Mark, it's been really good chatting with you and getting to know you and to get to know a little bit behind what's behind your music. And I hope that now that you have some free time, some more free time, you can continue recording and maybe we'll get some more music from you. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
It has been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
You can learn more about Mark Hargrave and listen to his music at markhargrave.com and also wherever you stream your music. Here now is Mark Hargrave with Our Lady of Love, featuring Teresa Smith.
Hail Mary, dear Mother, to thee we pray. You lead us to Jesus, you show us the way. You guide us with love, a comforting light. Your motherly heart shines ever so bright. Our Lady of Love, with arms open wide, guiding us home, you walk by our side. A beauty shone bright that shines like the stars. Blessed with grace, a gift from afar, a Lady of Love.
In times of despair, cry out to you, Mary, Mother of Hope, leading us through, embracing with love, soothing our pain, igniting our souls with faith to regain.
We're listening to Mark Hargrave and Teresa Smith with Our Lady of Love, and that will take us to the end of our show today. Remember that the best way to support us is to listen to our programs. Download the Salt and Light Plus app and take us wherever you go. Next week, we're going to be learning more about Mary's Meals, an organization that feeds some 3 million children in schools around the world every day. Find out more at marysmeals.org. We're also going to be featuring singer-songwriter Ali Aliyah, so you don't want to miss our show next week. Today, let's continue to pray for peace in our hearts, in our homes, and in our families. Let's pray for the poor and for each one of us to discover what we can do to help that one person in our lives. Let's pray for the good work of the Yonge Street Mission in Toronto, and also for all the organizations that are doing such good work to help those who are poor. And also let's pray for the situation in Nigeria. I also continue praying for you during this Advent season. I pray that our time together has blessed you. Please pray for me. And don't forget to pray for each other and take care of each other. I'm Deacon Pedro, and this has been the Salt and Light Hour.